Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius, Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on band.video, Rockfin, Odyssey, Vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We appreciate your amazing support. We can't do this show without the help of our sponsors. They've been fantastic for us. Our newest sponsor, Legal Shield. I think this is a fantastic service for people. I think people should take a look at it. It is the collective buying power of high-powered legal representation, and God knows we need it these days. This company's been in business for 50 years. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. They're available in the United States and Canada, and what they do is they get you together. It's $30 a month. It's like a dollar a day, and what you have is access to some of one of the best law firms in your area. The average attorney has 22 years of experience, so you're getting somebody that isn't fresh out of law school. And I asked this question. It's a very simple question for people. When was the last time you updated your will? It's probably been a while. That is, if you even have one. But look, as adults, we kind of got to do this stuff. We have to do the things that we don't love because we have to do it. You got to have a will for yourself. If you've got a spouse, there's another one right there. These things cost you $1,000 if you go into an attorney and try and have this done on your own. You need a power of attorney. You need a financial power of attorney. Look, there's a lot that we need to do in a way of getting ourselves ready. That comes in a lot of different forms and fashions. Get yourself ready with storable food. Get yourself ready with some money out of the bank. But also, you need to get your paperwork ready too. So I'll tell you what, we've set up a website that's specific just to me. You can go to www.don'tgetpushedaround.com and just see for yourself. They have, it's not just the legal package. There's an ID shield component to it you can add on. That's credit monitoring, reputation management. There's a small business plan. You can add that on as well. They say that we get equal justice under the law. Yeah, right. If you've been paying attention, I don't think that is the case. Look, from now on, if you have this service, if you have legal documents that you want an attorney to review before you sign them, definitely send that over to them. If your job is asking you to sign something that you're not really sure about, take it and send it to your attorney. Do these things right off the bat. Sign up. It's like I said, it's $30 a month. I think it's the best money you'll spend. You'll get your money's worth right off the bat if you get these legal documents taken care of. So go to the website, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com. And also, thanks to Chemical Free Body, they've been with us since the beginning. We appreciate them. It's nice to have a vitamin supplier that actually makes vitamins that work. You know, things like that are kind of a sketchy business out there. So I'm very grateful that I found Tim James. He's doing outstanding work in Oregon. You can go to chemicalfreebody.com and just take a look around. If you find something you like, use the promo code MACRO to save yourself some money on the way out. And anything that works to support our sponsors also helps to support the show. Well, all right. Now that the business is out of the way, I want to get to the real important stuff. This is a fantastic episode for me. This is somebody that I have had a great deal of respect for a long time. And I want to do this properly and I want to set up our guest the right way. In 2007, I was heading out the door on a two-week dive trip to Thailand and then a little jaunt over to Hong Kong. A friend of mine who was going to watch the animals came by and said, I've got a book I think you might want to read. It's called Confessions of an Economic Hitman by a guy named John Perkins. You've never heard of it, but you should read it. You'll like it. I remember being on the dive boat, reading this book over as much as I could read, going down underwater, checking my gauges, seeing, all right, it's about time. I got to head up and get some air. Looks like this dive is done. That's a shame, but at least I get to keep reading that book. I remember having this thought. It changed my life. It changed the orbit that my life took. It sent me in a different direction. It explained to me things that I had never thought of before. So it is my great pleasure to have the author of that book with us here today, John Perkins. Hey, John, it's nice to meet you. How are you?
I'm a little dizzy after that introduction, Charlie. I'm not sure whether you're basically saying that the book is all wet because you would read it while you're diving, or that it's for the animals because the guy taking care of your animals recommended it. So either way, I take that as a compliment.
Oh, man. I'll tell you. So here's the thing. Here's the thing about this book. And it sometimes it's the book. Sometimes it's the timing of the book. And this was a combination of the two. So at this moment in my life in 2007, I'm living in Las Vegas and I'm selling new homes. And it's the craziest real estate boom we've ever had, right? We've got people coming into our offices and they're trying to buy a home and they're filling out the credit application. We're faxing it over to our lender and our lender's going, well, yeah, the guy makes $10 an hour picking apples, but we'll approve him for a $405,000 house. And I'm thinking to myself, this is bad. This is really bad. This is a guy that has no business being able to buy this house. But you know, the bank says he's good for it. He wants the American dream. I can't fault him for that. You know, he's coming in, he's working hard, he's got a job. Maybe he is worth it, you know? And then I read your book. And what I see is this, and I don't connect the dots yet, but I see you talk about this on a macro scale, the World Bank, the IMF, approaching countries, third world countries that are essentially this buyer that I'm talking about. Doing okay, but don't really have the financial capacity to handle the loan that they're about to get. And when they fall behind on that payment, that they take back tangible assets. Well, listen, you fell behind, but you know, that's a shame. You owe us some money on this hydroelectric power plant that you built. Well, maybe we can work out a deal, right? Maybe you privatize your lumber industry and sell it to our buddies, or you vote our way in a UN resolution, or you do some shitty deal that you didn't want to do, right? Because you have to do it. And I'm watching this and I'm going, okay, so the banks are going to take back tangible assets, loaning this fraudulent fake Federal Reserve notes into the world and taking back something tangible. And then it clicked. Oh my God. I'm a part of this on a much smaller scale. And I had no idea. And that was the thing about your book that really woke me up, was that I didn't know that I was even a part of a smaller version of this. So that's the thing. When the light bulb goes off, I can't turn it off. So that's why it led me down to this path. I started writing books. I wrote a book called The Octopus of Global Control. You're quoted in there several times. You might find it in the chapter called The Emergence of the Economic Hitman. That's definitely towards you. So I appreciate this. And I wanted to make sure I reached out to you because I wanted to make sure that my audience heard the stories from you the way I read them. And of course, I encourage everybody to buy your books. You've got 10 books out there, and including the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which is this book right here, which has been updated, adding 15 more chapters to it, like it needed 15 more chapters. But thank you anyway. So I wanted people to hear your story and talk about where you, you know, what you came, what you did, where you came from. So I guess maybe the most logical place to start, if you will, is to just explain to us what an economic hitman is and what it is that you guys were out there doing.
Wow. Okay. So, and your story brings up another one, which I'll get into later. But, and I want to say that the next book is coming out in February. It's done now. You can actually pre-order it anywhere. It's called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, third edition. Okay. China's economic hitman policy, and how to stop this global takeover. Oh. And we really get into what's going on now, because China learned from the mistakes and the successes that I and other U.S. economic hitmen made. And they've done a more efficient job in recent years than we ever did, or than we continue to do. They've beaten us out in the last few years. That may be changing now, but anyway.
Something tells me that's going to involve Africa quite a bit.
Africa and Latin America especially, but okay. The whole world. But yeah, Africa, I mean, China has taken over Africa and Latin America at this point, economically. Now, they're not involved militarily, but economically, not very involved militarily. But so what we economic hitmen do, what I did and what the Chinese have been doing recently, is that we identify countries that have resources our corporations want, like oil or copper or cobalt, or today it's lithium is a big one.
Neodymium.
Yeah. And we arrange a huge loan to that country. We did it from the World Bank. China does it from the BRICS Bank or the AIIB Bank, their own version of the World Bank. And we arrange a huge loan to those countries, to that country. But the condition is that country will use the loan to hire our companies to build big infrastructure projects in that company. Things like electrical systems, industrial parks, highways, ports. Now, these things benefit a few wealthy families in the country, the ones that own the industries and they own the commercial centers that benefit from big infrastructure projects. But they actually hurt the majority of the people, at least in the short run, because they take money away from social services, education, healthcare, and other such things to pay the interest on the loans. And in the end, the loan can't be repaid. It's too big. It's like what you were saying, you know, the banks have put them in a position that, in fact, when you were selling real estate, our banks were doing that to people. They're saying, you know, they're telling a person that could only afford a $100,000 house, they could afford a $500,000 house. Well, these big banks are the same thing. And therein lies a specific story I'll get to in a minute. So they couldn't pay off their debt. So we go back in and say, hey, you know, since you can't pay your debt, sell your resources, oil, copper, whatever, real cheap to our corporations without any environmental or social regulations. Vote with us on the next United Nations vote that's important to us against China or against Cuba or against whatever. Allow us to build a military base on your soil. And, you know, in that way, we've really created this two things. We've created, at the time, we were creating an American hegemony, basically. We're making America become the number one world superpower, but basically a colonialistic viewpoint, and China's doing the same thing now, vying with us. But at the same time, we are also creating what we call the death economy, an economic system that's based on maximizing short-term profits and ravaging the earth. And this death economy is essentially consuming and polluting itself into extinction. It's the cause of climate change, of income inequality, species extinctions, environmental destruction. Those are all problems, but they're not the problem. They're symptoms of the problem, which is this economic system that's built on short-term profits and ravaging the earth and consumption, materialistic consumption. So that's what we were doing. We were creating that. And what I'm writing about now is how we need to turn that around and create what we know as the life economy, an economic system that pays people to clean up pollution, to mine the plastic that's floating around in the oceans and recycle it, to restore devastated environments, to recycle, to create new technologies that don't ravage the earth. And that's where we need to move now, which is, you know, what my life is about these days, is trying to look at the strategy, that the economic hitman strategy that we and the Chinese have used, and turn that into something that can actually make the world a place our children will want to inherit. And I should say, Charlie, that some people might well ask, well, why would these leaders of countries take on these onerous conditions? Well, and I've already mentioned that their families end up benefiting a lot from it.
Right.
But the other aspect is that they all know that behind me, if they don't accept my deal, are what we call the jackals.
Yeah.
And these are people, primarily CIA assets, not necessarily employees of the CIA, but contractors, who overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. And the United States has a long history that we've admitted to, with Allende in Chile and Lumumba in the Congo, and Diem in Vietnam, and Mossadegh in Iran, and on and on. So these leaders are in an interesting position of either accepting and bringing in more money for their families, and or facing the consequences.
And in 1981, a couple of your guys did face the consequences, and Jaime Roldos and General Omar Trujillo, right? They both were killed in plane explosions.
Yeah, these are two leads. Yeah, two leads. So Roldos was president of Ecuador, and Torrijos was head of state of Panama. They didn't buy the deal. They had tremendous integrity. They said, we're not going to do that to our countries. They told me, I was there, you know, working with them. And it, particularly Torrijos became a good, what I'd call a good personal friend. I had great admiration for both of these men, and they died in very suspicious airplane crashes, and both of them, Roldos in May, and less than 3 months later in June, Torrijos, that, you know, most of the world saw as CIA orchestrated assassinations. And I strongly believe that they were. It's no proof. Plane crashes are a great way to destroy the smoking gun.
Yeah, they are.
and they happen quite a bit. Yeah.
Ron Brown blows up in a plane crash. Then they find his body, and they go, well, there's an unusual bullet hole in the back of his head too. And, well, must have been the plane crash.
But, you know, and I wanted to get back to your banking experience.
Please.
Because Rafael Correa, who sort of followed in Torrijos' footsteps, he called himself a Roldista many years later, and he became president in the 90s for 10 years. And that was a record for Ecuadorian presidents. He also had a PhD in economics from the University of Illinois. He understood our system. And around 2007, 2008, during his first year as president of Ecuador, he appointed a commission to see, does Ecuador really owe all this money that the World Bank says we owe it? And this commission came to the conclusion that a lot of that money was not owed by Ecuador, because it had been taken on by a military dictatorship in Ecuador that was never elected, that was put into power pretty much by the CIA and kept there. And so, and you know, this PhD economist, who's a president of Ecuador, a very charismatic guy at the time, he said, well, we're not going to pay a lot of this debt. I can't remember the exact amount. I've written about it in the books, but it's a lot. And he defaulted on these loans. You know, so he said at the time, he said, the banks owe this money. They should never have given those loans to Ecuador, knowing that Ecuador couldn't repay, and that the consequences were that Ecuador would have to basically give its oil away free to U.S. oil companies, primarily Texaco, which is now owned by Chevron. So he said, you know, the Ecuadorian people don't owe this money. The bank should never have approved it. Just exactly what you were saying on a smaller level with real estate during that bubble. And it's funny because Correa, who I know personally, said, well, maybe John Perkins owes the money. The World Bank owes the money, but the Ecuadorian people certainly don't owe that money.
No.
And he defaulted. And the Standard & Poor's and Fitch, the rating agencies, looked, you know, put Ecuador in the tubes, you know, sank them, you know, like, yeah, they got no rating whatsoever, basically. And China came to the rescue and gave Ecuador a $1 billion loan and then another one at low interest, made it easy for them to pay it back. And then the credit ratings went up. So at that point, Ecuador became very, very convinced that the way to go was not U.S. banking systems, not Wall Street, not World Bank, but go through China. China seemed to offer them a better deal. And now Ecuador is deeply in debt to China. So something similar has been happening, and Correa is no longer president. In fact, he's now living in Belgium with his wife, who's from Belgium.
That explains something then, because I was trying to figure out what the connection was, why Ecuador was the first country to have China export their social credit system to a city in Ecuador. And I thought, that's unusual. That seems, you know, the facial recognition cameras tied into a cell phone, you know, caught smoking on the bus, get a $10 fine, it's deducted out of your Weibo account, and ding, 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 you know, within 7 minutes of this whole thing happening. I watched this happen in China and I thought, oh, this is like the end of humanity if this gets exported anywhere. And then they said, well, the first place it's been exported to is Ecuador. And I thought, why? Now it makes sense.
Yes. Well, it's not the Chinese, it's a few China's economic hitmen, basically, have been extremely effective at using a system that we've basically developed here in the United States. And they've learned to step in countries that we've exploited and where we've pissed people off and pissed leaders off, and China steps in. And one of the things that China offers a few things that we don't. First of all, China offers a model that says, and I have to preface this by saying, I'm not trying to defend China. People get very upset with me and say, well, China does a lot of bad things. Yes, they do a lot of bad things. But one of the good things they did was bringing 700 million people out of dire poverty. And nobody else has ever done anything like that. And they had their economy grew by about 10% a year for 30 years. Nobody else has done anything like that. So they've got this model that they can say to places like Ecuador, well, look, we've done a lot better than the United States has in these areas. They can say that, but it's, you know, there's two sides to every argument. But also, while the United States attaches to its loans what's called neoliberal economic policies, that we want to control governments, tell them how to operate themselves, how they should tax, how they should drop lower taxes on the rich and lower social services on the poor in order to pay off their debt and privatize, you know, don't let the government own any utilities or anything else. China says, we're not going to do that. We don't do that. We don't issue any policies. And to a large extent, it's been pretty true. China's also stated that we don't even need to get our loans paid back necessarily. We want you to be our friends. So China's looking very differently. And let's remember that the big Chinese corporations have a large share of their ownership is government. And the government wants to make friends around the world. This has been very true in Africa, where they've managed to do it successfully. So they offer this thing called the New Silk Road, which they also say, well, this is going to connect you with the whole world. So Ecuador, you don't need to just trade with us, which is what the United States asked. We're going to help you trade with Peru and Colombia, your neighbors, but we're also going to help you build a port so you can trade with Africa and Asia and every place else in the world. And you know, it's a very, very attractive, extremely good marketing tool. Whatever the reality behind all of this is, China's got a very, very good marketing tool, which may now be changing because, you know, China's going through its own series of problems, many problems right now. So that may be changing, but it has been an extremely effective tool for the last decade or two.
Well, I put that in one of my books, that when talking about Africa and the relationship with China and Africa, in comparison to the relationship between America and Africa, I said, well, look, China builds hospitals for sick Africans instead of graveyards for dead ones, which is what America does, you know, in that need of going in there and providing them with something that they want and need and don't have access to, I think goes a long way, as opposed to the American imperial interventionist policy, which is comes in immediately aggressively, or well, diabolically, first through the hitman and then the economic hitman, and then overtly occupying your forces. Where as opposed to China, which seems like they say, well, let's partner up, let's work as partners. Now, whether or not they keep their agreement remains to be seen. But as you said, they do. In fact, earlier today, I just saw a map they were showing of the countries in 2000 that primarily traded with the United States, map of the world, a lot of blue and some red for China. And then it showed in 2020, and it was almost all red, except for Western Europe and Canada. So the idea of China's expansion into this, I mean, in America, we think, oh, the Chinese are going to come invade us. It's like, well, I don't know. They seem like they're taking a page out of the British Empire, which is less overt, overt control in the way of like empires, and more covert control, like the British have done through banking, and the Chinese have done a little bit more through trade. So it seems like a partnership that could go wrong, but at least these countries in South America and in Africa are getting something out of the deal from China, right?
Yes, and of course, one of the things they get is an option. So back when I was an economic hitman in the 70s, other countries could turn to the Soviet Union. So mm-hmm. if I get a little bit too, if I strong-armed a little too hard, the president of a country could say, well, let's entertain a proposal from the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And that might make me back off a little bit. And in most cases, nobody really wanted to deal with the Soviet Union. And, you know, people could be Marxists, but they didn't see the Soviet Union as Marxist. They saw it as Stalinist, you know. And right. And so nobody that I knew in Latin America or Africa wanted to follow the Soviet model. And it wasn't a very successful model economically. That's not true with China. Right. But there was a balance. They could still use that Soviet as leverage. And then after the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, the United States had free reign up until shortly after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And after 9/11, of course, we focused all of our attention on Iraq and Afghanistan, the Middle East. We basically forgot about the rest of the world. And China stepped right in. There was a void. Yeah. China stepped in. And also, China offered this alternative. So suddenly there's another, and it's a much more viable alternative than the Soviet Union ever was, because they have a model that has proven to be successful in many ways. Yeah. And on the other hand, Charlie, I do want to point out, and I mentioned a lot in my book, how China's done some very, very bad projects. In Ecuador, it's built a hydroelectric dam, a huge one. It's essentially failed. They built it on a fault line next to an active volcano, and its generating house, which has 8 generators, is filled with cracks. No more than 4 of those generators have ever operated. It's a failure. They're building a few big mines in Ecuador, which they're building under very poor engineering standards. So, you know, I think it's very important to understand that China's made a lot of mistakes in this process of their own. And one of them is their faulty engineering. And because of that, they are pissing off a lot of countries who, so again, I say things may be in the process of changing that, but a lot of that depends on what the United States does next.
Well, you worked, let's stay on the topic of engineering then, because you worked for a company called Maine, which is the modern day equivalent of Halliburton or Bechtel, a multinational engineering firm that builds the big, big projects. So I'm curious, what is the sales pitch for you? Or what was the sales pitch back then when you would approach, let's stay in Ecuador. You would approach them and say, you've got nice topography here. You've got the makings of the layout for a fantastic hydroelectric power plant here. This, how does that go? Does that go that I'm assuming it's friendly the whole time? There's no implied threats or anything like that. This is a business deal. We're working together. Do they recognize who you are and what you're doing, or is this a surprise to them? Like, what is that? Walk me through how that sales pitch is on from your end to a country like Ecuador, trying to, you know, approaching them about what you bring to the table.
Yeah, so we would do usually there would be a small amount of money donated by the United States Agency for International Development,
USAID. Yeah, regime change.
And that, And that would be given to me, to my department, or, you know, if I won the bid, to do a small study. And we're talking in today's term, a few million dollars, probably, to determine what project could we do in the country that would best increase gross domestic product. And we'd come up with, let's say, a hydroelectric project, which we did often. And because that's something we would also build, or we would manage the construction of it, yeah, make a lot of money off that. But we could show that, and then the country would have to go out and get a loan from the World Bank for the huge amount of money that would be needed to build the project. So they'd get a little grant to do a study that would lead to a huge investment.
You had that loan ready to go in advance, right? You had the World Bank, IMF saying, John, do what you need to do. Like when the time is right, we'll step in, right?
Yes. Yes. And we would show that if you build this project, the gross domestic product is going to increase rapidly in the future. Mm-hmm. And the president then, or minister of finance, all of those people could go out to their people and say, hey, look, we're taking out this loan because it's going to increase our prosperity. And we don't even really need to pay for it. It's the collateral is oil. And it's in the ground. It's there. We've got all this oil. And we're going to let their companies take it out. We don't need to do anything. So it'd be presented as almost this gift that would help their prosperity grow. And I believe that for many years, Charlie. So I was in this business for 10 years. But probably 7 of those years, I believe that what I was doing was really helping these countries. Right. Because all the economic models show that it does. Because in fact, when you build these projects, GDP does grow. But then I began to understand, primarily because Omar Torrijos of Panama helped me understand. And I looked into the details of what GDP really represents. And it represents money primarily for the rich, for big business. It is a statistic that is not skewed toward the poor. So it doesn't represent prosperity. And let me give you a simple example. Back of the envelope. This is very oversimplified. But in the United States, 3 individuals have as much money as half the population. Today, it's a little more than half the population. If those 3 individuals made 10% on their assets last year, and half the country lost 3%, and the rest of the country remained the same, you'd show an overall increase of almost 4%. So it would look like prosperity rose for everyone, when in fact, prosperity only rose for 3 individuals and their families.
Interesting.
And half the population suffered, and half the population remained the same. But it would look like everybody prospered. So the statistics that we use are skewed in favor of our corporations primarily. But I didn't know that for a long time. And today most people don't know. Most economists don't know that. They don't get it. They keep using GDP as the standard measure of prosperity. It is a measure of certain things, but it isn't necessarily a measure of overall prosperity.
And what did you see in Ecuador? Because I know post this economic hitman life, you've been almost devoted to the country of Ecuador in particular, or Latin America in general. What happened in Ecuador after this hydroelectric power plant got built and started to produce revenue? It started to increase GDP. What was the quality of living like in those regions? Did they now have electricity to read at night and teach their kids at night? And did they have all these little things that they were promised? Or was it sort of a bait and switch for the people as well, as not just for the bankers, but for the indigenous people that were there?
It's a mixture. I want to first say that our projects are well engineered, unlike what I described about China. Right. I think our engineers did a really good job. But when you dam up a river, it causes all sorts of problems for small farmers upriver and downriver, and for people who live off fishing and off the environment. It can cause environmental damage. We're seeing that, you know, as a controversial issue these days. And in general, most of the electricity didn't go to the people anywhere near the project. And let me So this is true in Ecuador, but I want to bring up another point, which is the neighboring country, Colombia, where we also did some huge hydroelectric projects. And they essentially created the revolutionary movements that became FARC and several of the others that we hear about, because those started because people who live near the project sites and all along these huge transmission lines that went from the hydro dams up into the cities of Bogota, Medellin, Cali, and Barranquilla and others, these people didn't get electricity, but these huge lines went over their land and the river had been altered. And so these organizations got started to resist many of these kinds of projects. And the Soviet Union did provide them with some money, very limited resources. But once the Soviet Union ended, they turned to extortion, they turned to kidnapping and murder and all sorts of things to keep going. And then they got into drugs. So things turned around. But they were very upset with these projects. Now, I also want to point out that statistically, we can show that a lot more people in the world today have running water, do have electricity, they have cell phones. You can make the argument that their lives are better off. But often these people live under very squalid conditions. They may have houses, they may have running water, but the water may not be potable. They have it, but it's running through pipes that are filthy. And they may get sick from it, and they're living they're malnourished. So they have cell phones, but they're living in houses that are built out of toxic materials often. And so it's a real mixed bag when we show that, you know, more people have electricity and water, which we definitely can show. And we can even show that life expectancy has risen. But has the quality of life risen? And in most all of these countries, the division between the wealthy and the poor has continued to expand. The wealthy have gotten wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. And that's certainly true in the United States, too. We know that.
Yeah, I was going to say that we exported that.
Yes, and it's true in China also, incidentally.
Yeah. China's an interesting place. What's your take on China now? What do you think they have planned for Hong Kong and Taiwan?
I don't know, but you know, when you go over there, and I've taught at an MBA program there. I spent time there, and in some of the Central Asian countries like Kazakhstan, and I've spoken in Russia and other. And you know, I've gotten to know some of these people. It's interesting because if I bring up Taiwan and Hong Kong, they bring up Afghanistan and Iraq. They say, "What the hell are you doing there?"
Right.
And if you bring up the Uyghurs and other minorities, they say, well, what about your immigration, the way you treat immigrants in these horrible camps that you put them in? And what about your prisoners? You have a huge amount of prisoners in your country. So, you know, it's interesting how we countries manipulate, you know, through propaganda, the attitude that we have toward each other. So in the United States, I often hear the word the nefarious Chinese, right. You know, but I don't think it's nefarious. I think they're trying to do what they think is right for most of them. I get that. It's hard to say. It's like a lot of them don't even understand what's going on. Just like in this country, we don't understand what's going on. But to me, the most important thing is to recognize that today China is a rising power. It's a huge economy. It's a very powerful country. Whether we like it or not, that's the facts. And the fact is that together, the United States and China produce about 50%, almost 50% of the world's economy and about 50% of the world's pollution. And so if we don't recognize that we are together, these two countries are causing a death economy and that nobody prospers, nobody survives on a dead planet, we've got to end this. And so I like to say that, you know, we, the United States and China and Europe and everybody else, we can disagree on many, many things. But we need to agree that we're going to end the insanity of this death economy.
Yeah, let's elaborate on that. Let's define the death economy, because we see here in America, you know, the American consumerism, this concept where we're just going to use our I'll use my toaster for 3 years and then I'll throw it in the trash and buy a new one. functional obsolescence being taught in colleges. I went to USC. They're teaching us in our business classes. Well, you know, there's this component called functional obsolescence where you make the product just good enough to last 5 years, but not good enough to last 8 years. And you go, oh my God. So I would see this in like on a smaller scale. But I can imagine how it scales up when you're not talking about toasters, where you're talking about cobalt, right? So as long as we're living in a world where we've got consumerism driving demand, it seems logical that there will be somebody there to fill that demand. And it seems like, it seems like it's either going to be the United States or it's going to be China, right? So how do we change that paradigm? How do we change that way of thinking where you stop, where you transition out of maybe this temporary or this consumer, everything's disposable way of thinking and into a more sustainable way of living?
Well, that's the question of our times. It's the question of our times. And the real question is, do we want to survive? Do we want our children and grandchildren to survive? It's time that we really took that question seriously. And we tend to be pretty frivolous. You know, perception molds reality. Charlie, there is no China, there's no United States, there are no corporations, there's no culture, there's no religion except as people perceive them. Mm-hmm. And when enough people accept a perception or codify it into law, it has a huge impact on reality. There's no question, you know. Perception is what molds quantum physics.
Yeah, right.
Marketing, politics, it's all about perception. And we've grown up with this perception that we need more and more and more and more stuff. And we don't, you know. Some people say we have to stop growth. Well, I kind of object to that, because if you're starving, you need more growth of the food to you. Yeah. And there's a lot of starving people in the world. We need to re-examine what we mean by growth. We need growth in things that clean up pollution. We need growth in businesses that that restore destroyed environments. We need growth in businesses that, instead of going out and mining more copper, will recycle the copper that's already here. Right. And in buildings that are being torn down, or cars, or whatever, you know, computers. We need growth in businesses that support a life economy. We don't need growth in more materialistic stuff, just more stuff. You know, I've had this shirt for many, many years, as you can probably tell. And it's also, it's made out of an organic plant. You know, I think it's important for us all to realize that we need to keep things longer. We need to buy things that'll last. And unfortunately, China's taking us in the opposite direction. This company called Shein, you know, that encourages you to buy thousands of shirts. And some people are doing it. And throw them away. Wear a shirt one time. It's cool. You know, it's got this great inscription on it. Wear it and throw it away, and then wear another one. Because it only cost you $3. I may have my numbers wrong here. That's the wrong way to go. But, you know, as you said, we've been doing this in the United States for a long time, too, with planned obsolescence. And we need to get beyond that and recognize that the goal is no longer short-term profits or short-term materialistic consumption. The goal is to maximize long-term benefits for all life. Because that's what our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren will thank us for. Otherwise, we go over the precipice. Yeah. And, you know, frankly, we're headed for the precipice now, but there's a lot of people putting the brakes on and talking about reversing and let's go the other direction. And the other direction is the life economy. We can do it. The pandemic has been an amazing teaching tool in that it's taught us that we can change. Mm-hmm. And we can even benefit from the change. You know, how many people do I know that have said things like, oh my God, I always wanted to learn to play the flute. Right. the pandemic gave me the opportunity. I always wanted to write a book. The pandemic gave me the opportunity. So we see that we can change. We tend to fear change. that, and that's the biggest problem. One of the biggest problems right now is this fear. Oh my God, if we move into a life economy, does that mean I can't live in this house any longer? Does that mean I can't go to Europe next year like I'm planning on doing? Does that mean that I can't? We need to really examine those things, not what it means that we can't do, but what does it mean that we can do? It'll be so much better. We'll have better air to breathe. And that's another important point about China, is the young Chinese people have experienced horrible pollution.
Yeah.
Like nothing our kids have ever experienced. LA went through it for a short period of time, but not nearly as any to the extent that Beijing or Shanghai has gone through it, or other Chinese cities.
And I've lived in LA, and my buddy and I went to USC together. We thought we had seen smog, and then we were both in Shanghai. I was like, this is LA times a million. He's like, yeah, this is really bad. So,
yeah. And those kids, young people that I taught at this MBA program, China's future leaders, they've lived through that, and they're very adamant. We don't want that for our children.
Mm.
We're going to end this.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah, I hope they do it. And I hope we all do it.
Well, you and I have a mutual friend in common, Ross Ashcroft. He is the great director of Four Horsemen. I was in London a couple of years ago. I swung by and he had me on his show, Renegade Inc. I suggest that everybody go out and watch this documentary. You can find it online for free. You can just watch this. But I had been done, I'd read your books, and then here you are on camera. I said, well, hang on a second. Now I got a chance to see the guy that wrote the book. What was that? Obviously they're using the Four Horsemen metaphor, so sort of like the apocalyptic times, but really that's just an opportunity for changing, right? So, I'm curious this idea where we're talking about, I don't know, the end of times. Is it the end of times, or is it just the end of this current era that we're in and potentially the beginning of something better? I mean, how optimistic should we be about where we're going here?
If I didn't have a great deal of hope, I wouldn't be talking to you.
Okay.
I wouldn't write books.
Good.
Because it would be futile. And I know people have given up, but I haven't given up by any means. I remember my grandmother, who I call Nana, my Nana, saying, I went through World War I, the 1918 influenza, the Great Depression, World War II. We all thought the world was going to end during all those times.
Yeah.
But we had faith and courage and patience and stick-to-itiveness, perseverance.
Yeah.
And we're at a time like that now. And human beings have had an uncanny ability to survive tough times. And it almost always involved sacrifice. Mm-hmm. All of those things I just mentioned involve sacrifice, huge ones in the case of these wars,
right,
and the depressions. We need to be willing to make some sacrifices now, and maybe to have a different perception and not call them sacrifices, but call them opportunities. Rather than what's the cost of me buying a better product and keeping it longer? No, it's not a cost. It's an investment. You're making an investment in the future. If you buy that Shein shirt for $3 or whatever, throw it away. That's a cost. But if you buy this shirt and keep it for 50 years, I haven't had it that long, but that's an investment.
Yeah.
And so we need to start redefining many of these things in our lives. Sustainable construction. Oh my God, I can't afford to pay for the wood for this cabinet, which is sustainable because it's a little more expensive. No, it's not a cost. It's an investment. I'm investing in my grandson with this.
Yeah.
So, we need to turn this around, and I'm encouraged that we are in the process of doing it. B corporations, benefit corporations, the Green New Deal, conscious capitalism, the Chinese people saying we can't bring our children up with this kind of pollution again, on and on and on. There's so many indications. The pandemic taught us that we can change. It also set us back a bit. And the war in Ukraine is setting us back even more. Hopefully these are just blips. Nobody has a crystal ball. We don't know what'll be next. And I believe that if we will only recognize that we must make alterations, which you could call sacrifices, or you could call them opportunities to do things differently, mm-hmm. Which I prefer, the opportunity. But we have to do this, you know, at some point, and it is going to require change on some level. The life economy doesn't require that we all live like Stone Age people.
No.
Because we pay people to clean up pollution and restore destroyed environments and recycling, on and on and on. We pay people to do this. You know, and we've been talking about this recently in the United States, where we look at the economic opportunities of employing people to build more wind farms and solar units and moved in more and more in the direction of sustainable materials, and pay people, train people to be able to do this. Yeah. That's the way we've got to go. And some people might look at that as a sacrifice. They hear coal miners saying, well, I don't want to give mining coal, even if the government will train me to become an installer of solar units. Right. Well,
we gotta make some change.
Look at it as an opportunity, not as a sacrifice.
Well, let's wrap up with this, because you give some people opportunities on your shamanic tours through Ecuador and Guatemala and Costa Rica. What is that like? How can people have the ability to just go hang out with you and go get on an adventure? Talk to me about what that all entails. I mean, are we talking ayahuasca here, or are we talking about a little of everything?
Well, I've got a trip coming up in a couple of weeks to the Amazon. You can go to my website, johnperkins.org, to find the details. That trip is full now. But there's another one to the Mayan people of Guatemala in January, which still has some available. We don't take more than 15 people. And for example, the Maya have an incredible message to teach us. And that is that they went through this before, back around the year 900 in our calendar. These magnificent cities, these huge pyramids and temples that they built, tremendous numbers of cities. They were finding more and more every year. In building those cities, they cut the forests and they drained the swamps, and they changed their climate. And as they changed their climates, they could no longer produce their crops. So the system was failing, very much like ours is. They were destroying their world as they knew it. And now this caused huge social disruptions. So cities that had been friendly suddenly became antagonistic, because this city wanted more resources from this city. They imposed sanctions on trading between cities, which they used to have great trading networks. They stopped doing that to some degree. And then they became warlike. There was real antagonism between these cities. At the same time, people migrated out of these cities back into the forest, or they migrated from this city to this city that had more resources, had more power. Wow. Sounds familiar?
Yeah, we think we're inventing all this stuff. We're just playing it out in a loop.
The Maya did it, and they experienced it. And today, I take people, like in January, this group was magnificent, and we have Mayan shamans and elder teachers travel with us the whole time. And they tell us these stories, and we do the fire ceremonies. We do these many shamanic journeys and traditions around how to envision changing this perception, how to look at each individual, what do I do to change? And incidentally, then my new book, the one that comes out in February, which you can pre-order now at my website or at economichitmanbook.com, goes into what we each can do. There's a whole section devoted to really specifically about what can you do if you're, anyway. But so these trips, the Mayan people really, really get it. They've been through it, and they're determined to try to teach us not to follow in those footsteps and how to avoid that. And they do all these ceremonies around empowering us to do that. Their fire ceremonies are magnificent. Their shamanic journeys that they take us on are phenomenal, very, very powerful.
Yeah, I love that. I had a great fire ceremony, blue deer ritual, peyote ritual in Mexico with these shamans that were so far out in the desert woods of Mexico that they didn't even speak Spanish. They were like so authentic, and they came, they were very small people, and they would translate to one guy that understood it, and he would say it in Spanish, and then they'd tell it to us, and we, oh my God, the whole thing blew my mind. But I in America we have this sort of, oh well, did they go to university? You know, it's like, you know, how could they be educated? I tell you what, man, I've learned quite a bit from these savages in the third world, you know, when they have these ceremonies, I've done some of the ayahuasca ceremonies, and you and have this interaction with these people, and I have come to humble myself before them that there is a whole world out there filled with information and knowledge, and we dismiss that at our own peril. And it seems that these people have been so much better at connecting to that information and and incorporating it into their lives and their values. And I think we could learn a hell of a lot from these people.
Yeah. Yeah. They've been through it and they've survived it. And one of the shamans that travels with us the whole time in Guatemala grew up very Mayan, speaking up Mayan. And his father was the lead in charge of the Mayan teams that did the excavation of Tikal, which is the most excavated, beautiful, incredible Mayan city, huge, huge pyramids that to me are far superior to anything you find in Egypt, frankly. Mm. And they're still used in their ceremonies. It's in this beautiful jungle area. There's over 100 jaguars living there. It's just amazing wildlife. It's where we take people. He grew up there. And then he decided to reject that, and he ended up going to college and going to law school in Guatemala. He became a lawyer. And then he went on a trip with me many years ago and was so taken by the Mayan shaman that I was working with, that he trained with that shaman for 5 years. He stopped being a lawyer, went and lived and trained with that shaman for 5 years. And now he is a highly certified shaman, and he travels with us the whole time. He speaks Mayan, K'iche, he speaks Spanish, and he speaks English fluently. And he really, and it's amazing to see this perspective of this guy who's done the full circle and takes us back to Tikal, where he crawled around as an infant with his father. You know, this amazing site, which is just incredible. And unlike the Mexican Mayan sites, you don't get a lot of tourists there, because you got to know, I mean, anybody can get there, but it's not easy. And to go in there, and we spend several days there with this shaman and another, at least one other one who doesn't speak English at all, doesn't even really speak very good Spanish, who have these incredible traditions that we practice these ceremonies in these sacred sites. It's amazing. And you know, they're very aware of what we're doing that's repeating the mistake their people made all those many years ago. And now we're repeating it, but on a much larger level.
Will we listen, though? That is the real question. Or will our arrogance get in our way and blind us? Well, I'll tell you what. Thank you for what you've done. Thank you for writing your books. It takes a lot of guts to admit that you were part of that machine. And I think that it, as a show of good faith, your devotion, commitment to restoring the planet, for helping these particular, these countries like Ecuador, I think it more than absolves you of any of these I don't know, whatever people might have associated with you of being part of this machine. Hell, I was part of the machine too, in my own little way, in selling Las Vegas real estate and not figuring it out until the very end, and then deciding, wait a second, this is wrong. I need to move on to something. I respect the hell out of you for making that change and for educating everybody on where we are and what we're doing, and that we're walking into a huge trap if we don't turn it around. So thank you, John, for your outstanding work.
Well, thanks for saying that, Charlie. You're welcome. And thank you for what you're doing to bring all this to people's attention. I deeply, deeply appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you. Well, guys, if you like this episode, take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. You can follow me on Twitter at macroaggression, and the website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thanks, everybody. We'll take care.